Hello, welcome to Weekend Life Matters. Michael McKenzie here, and we're going to transform your world today through things like painting. We're going to reacquaint you with your favourite tree, and we're going to dare you to help a person with low vision cook in their own kitchen.
They will hover, sighted people will hover and actually watch you cutting because they're like, oh, I don't want anything to go wrong. Or they put a plate closer to me just at the moment where I'm plonking something on it. Mm. I sort of need people out the way.
Life inside a tactile kitchen soon. But first, if you've ever tried to photograph a child running through a sprinkler, you'll know how hard it is to get that exact moment where something in motion just looks amazing. Now, imagine taking that photo with the child running 20,000 times faster and standing 400 kilometres away. Oh, and one more thing, you'll have less than half a second to get the lighting right or the opportunity will be lost forever. Yeah, no pressure. That's basically what astrophotographer Ken Lawson did recently when Ken shot the International Space Station passing over the moon. His image has been called the shot of a lifetime by astronomers and astrophotography fans around the globe. But Ken says with a bit of practice, almost anyone could do the same thing. Really, Ken? He's talking here with Hilary Harper.
Ken, it took you 8 years to get this shot. Tell us all the elements that had to be in place for it to come off.
So this kind of shot you can actually do quite often because this event occurs everywhere. But the problem is it only occurs at certain locations. So you have to be at that exact location. So I waited 8 years for it to happen in my location and for all the elements to come together, i.e. the weather, and to be in exactly the right spot at the right time.
And what time of night was it when you finally got it?
It was about 7 o'clock at night, so it was actually a good time. It wasn't too dark or too early, because sometimes you might have to do it at, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning or 5 o'clock in the morning. So 7 o'clock was good.
I did wonder if you ever sleep. I had a look at your portfolio. It's like a lot of night shots.
Yeah. I'm a bit of a night owl, so that does help.
Well, since the photo was published, you've been contacted by astronomers and media outlets worldwide. How are you feeling about it?
I'm very humbled. I mean, to be contacted from places in the UK and all over the world, Norway, everywhere you can imagine. It's just, yeah, very humbling.
And the International Space Station is really small compared to the moon and the Earth. How does it look in the photo? Tell us what it looks like.
So it looks like an alien spacecraft, you know, a little white dot in front of the moon. And zoom in and you can actually see some of the details. So this shot, I'd like to do again because I'd like to get a bit more detail into the space station.
But it's not perfect enough.
No, it's not. So we're always our worst critics when we look at our own work. So when you look at other people's work and you go, oh, they've got a better shot. So, you know, you want to do it again, but I have to try and chase the location. So it could be traveling hundreds of kilometres or I might have to wait another 8 years for it to happen again.
Well, and it's an amazing shot too because it's not a line being tracked across the moon. It's a series of little pinpoints of light. How does it come to look like that, Ken?
So, yeah, if you want to do the line shot, which I've done, which is quite easy, anyone can do that with a camera on a tripod and they can do a line image of the International Space Station going over and above them. So all you do is do a long exposure. So you might do a 30-second exposure and you'll get that big streak line effect. So what I did was actually do multiple shots. So I did 4,000 frames per second. So as the moon was there and the space station came towards it, I quickly fired off a whole rapid succession of shots and then put those together. So that's where you can see individual shots of the space station in front of the moon.
And just to clarify for our listeners, that's not an automated process, is it? How long was that window where you had to press that button manually?
About 0.3 seconds.
Give or take.
Yeah, around that. So the whole event, if the moon was full and the space station was zooming in past it, because it travels so fast, which is 27,600 kilometres per hour. So imagine driving that fast in your car. It takes 0.9 seconds to go in front of the face of the full moon. Because it was the first quarter, so literally half of the moon was lit, it was only very, very short amount of time. So it was prey, well, you press the button and you got the shot.
So how do you predict where the space station's going to be at that particular time?
So there's a couple of websites you can use. You can use something called Kalsky, which is absolutely a brilliant website. And you can actually set up a notification. So if you want to know when these kind of events occur, you can put in your location and what kind of parameters you want to see. So do you want to see it in front of the moon, in front of the sun, or any other objects like planets and big stars and stuff like that? And it'll actually send you an email a week or two before the event occurs. And then you need to constantly update your data to know exactly where it's going to happen, because as more data comes in, i.e. telemetry of where the space station is, it'll constantly update. So even to the point where I needed to look an hour or two before the event was going to occur, because the path that was predicted was actually shifted. So if I'd gone with the old data, I would have missed it.
Wow. You don't like to think about that now, do you?
No, not particularly.
So is it like needing to understand the longitude and latitude of the sky, but kind of in 3D?
Yeah, essentially, if you're looking down and you look at a map with the latitude and longitude, and you look up, it's just exactly the same. So we're using the same kind of coordinate system. But it pretty much is pretty easy if you know where the moon is and you know that the space station is going to cross in front of it. You just look at the moon and eventually you'll see it.
So, Ken, you're completely self-taught, but how did you first get into taking photos of space?
Well, I think it started from a love of astronomy and photography. So my dad used to be a photographer, and we always used to play around with cameras and films and photography and looking up at the sky. And eventually when, you know, the days of digital came about and the telescope technology got better, and eventually you think, oh, I could put these two together and get some photos. So in the days of film, doing astrophotography was actually a really tedious, hard and very mysterious thing that you're lucky to get a shot. But these days with digital, it's so much easier. So yeah, the love of putting those together just, yeah, it's always been with me. And my dad used to, as I say, used to be a photographer, and my bedroom when I was a little kid used to be the dark room.
So you've got the smell of developer in your blood.
Yeah, so we actually had developer and fix it at the end of my bedroom when I first moved into the room. So it was, part of my blood indeed.
There must be something amazing about watching those images slowly emerge in the fixing bath, but I imagine it's much better now just going, yep, nope, yep, nope, delete.
I actually miss it. I mean, I don't miss the smell. Anyone who's ever worked in the dark room can tell you the smell is very overpowering. But I'd like to smell it a couple of times just to remind myself. But yes, putting a piece of photographic paper into developer and watching that image appear is a memory that I'll never, ever forget. And yes, it is so much easier to be able to look at the back of the screen or even with a phone and get that instant gratification. But spending the time of making that photo appear is a magical thing.
We're chatting with Ken Lawson. He's an astrophotographer. I didn't even know there were such things until now. And he's taken this incredible shot of the International Space Station tracking across the moon's surface. You can check it out online. Ken, people would assume that to get this kind of shot, you would need a lot of fancy equipment. Tell us what you used.
I used really basic equipment. So I used an off-the-shelf camera and a really cheap $500 off-the-shelf telescope. Essentially using the telescope as a giant lens. So you can actually do this shot with a telephoto lens as well. But I wanted to use the telescope because it was a bit easier to handle and you can actually get higher fidelity.
Yeah, and 0.3 of a second, you're not going to mess around with that.
No, definitely not.
Can you do it with a smartphone?
You could do it with a smartphone if you had it attached to a telescope. So you can actually do lots of astrophotography with your phone, especially with the moon and the planets. But I don't think I'd want to do that if I waited 8 years. I want to use something as best as I could that I had. But you could actually do it with a phone.
Now, images like yours are so beautiful and so inspiring, but can they also be useful to science?
Yeah, so one of the best things about astrophotography and astronomy, amateur astronomy itself, is it's one of the only hobbies that really can contribute to actual science. So there's a lot of citizen science astrophotographers and amateur astronomers out there that are contributing to real science and actually helping to us, for us to understand the universe and our place in it. So things like an event like the impact on Jupiter, that was discovered by Shoemaker-Levy, the asteroid and comet that actually hit Jupiter. That was actually discovered and photographed by an amateur, and there's been heaps of events like that. So, yes, citizens are actually contributing to real science.
And today is a big day for astrophotographers too, because we think the first ever image of a black hole is going to be unveiled. How can you have a picture of a black hole, though? Don't they just swallow everything? Light, Hollywood actors?
Yes, time itself. Yeah, yeah, they're a mind-boggling weird thing. And yes, everyone is excited because we might be able to see the influence of a black hole. So we won't be able to directly see the black hole itself, the actual event horizon, because they say it swallows Hollywood actors and space and time and light itself. So everything gets gobbled up by it. But we were able to see the actual surrounding matter being influenced by the event horizon and the singularity itself. So it's going to be an amazing thing if we actually get to see an actual black hole. Because, you know, at the beginning of this century, they were pretty much, well, last century, I should say, they were actually theorized. So they weren't even known to exist. And then we've been able to see the influence of them. And now we might even get to see a picture. So amazing.
It's an exciting time to live in. Now, Ken, you've said that anyone can take a shot like this, but you do live in a particularly good spot for it. What's special about Geraldton in this sense?
We're lucky over here because we're able to quickly and easily get to a location that's nice and dark. So light pollution is one of those nasty, evil things that's, you know, destroying our night skies globally. And to be able to have a location like Geraldton where you can travel 5-10 minutes outside of the main city and get to see the night sky is just an absolute blessing. And anyone who hasn't seen the Milky Way should get out and able to see it.
I do love the shots on your website. You've got, you know, obviously the Sith Lord out in the field with the lightsaber, but there's beautiful shots of a galaxy over a canola field, and it's just this lovely blending of the stellar and the mundane. How do people react when they go out, for example, on one of the star tours that you run and see those stars in such a huge, clear sky?
I think everyone loves looking up at the night sky, but it's especially poignant for people that don't have that opportunity. People that come from China, for example, who live in a huge metropolis city with maybe smog, and they don't get to see what we have down here. And so for them to be able to come to a place like Geraldton, walk out of their bus and look up at the night sky and see the Milky Way straight over the top without any effort whatsoever, it becomes quite moving for them. We get all sorts of reactions, and it's great to be able to share that with those people who haven't seen something as stunning and as mundane as what we think that we can see every night down here.
Well, you were part of the huge star party that happened in Australia last year, and I understand they're quite frequent events. What was involved there, and did you think it got more people interested?
Yeah, so definitely organising things like star parties and getting families introduced to the accessibility of astronomy. You don't have to have all this fancy equipment. You can just walk outside with a cup of tea in your hand and look up at the night sky and see amazing things. And then you think, okay, I might get a pair of binoculars, or I might get a small telescope. It's really accessible. So to be able to share that with people, especially in an event with like-minded people, is just, yeah, it's one of the best things around.
So you've got a son. How's he reacting to your passion for this kind of thing?
He absolutely loves it, and he actually gets right involved into it and likes reading books and asking lots of questions. And whenever there's an event like the space station passing over, I say, hey, come on, son, do you want to have a look at the space station? Yeah, let's go down, let's have a look. Where is it? Where is it? Where is it? And he'll wave to him, and, you know, he's right into it. So it's great to see.
Ken Lawson, a self-taught astrophotographer and amateur astronomer, whose photo of the International Space Station passing across the surface of the moon has gotten international attention, and it's well deserved. Have you seen it yet? If not, you can catch it on the Life Matters website, where there's a link to the ABC News story as well. Hello, Michael McKenzie here, and I'd like to talk about vision. We can lose our ability to see for a whole range of reasons. Sometimes it's hereditary, other times it's because of an accident or a disease like diabetes.
Hello.
Oh, God.
Did I scare you? Sorry.
Maribel Steele lost her eyesight when she was a teenager.
Thank you so much. Come in.
Thank you.
And for years leading up to that, she just flat out refused to believe her vision was failing.
Oh, will you just say, do you want to give it to her? Just sit down.
Now, Maribel wants to help others accept what's happening to them and then to find strategies to deal with it. She's written a book called Blindness for Beginners.
I guess right now, as you maybe look around, or I'll just point out to you,
yeah.
I have some markers, like tactile markers on my oven and my microwave, just here, see?
There is this felt pad that's been stuck to the temperature range on Maribel's oven, and it's at 180.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Right.
So that's a moderate oven.
Okay. I visited Maribel's house to negotiate one of the most lethal rooms for anyone with visual impairment.
My microwave, it shows me where the button is to press to go. Over here I have a rubber band that shows me my cupboard with all my glasses and cupware so I can get to it quickly.
Right.
So if you can feel that.
So, oh yes.
Because you're going to find that for our champagne glasses later.
Maribel still cooks from scratch most nights. She's invited me to make a meal with her, and to do that without full vision.
You may have a choice of three eye conditions.
She's handed me three special sets of cardboard glasses to put on.
Well, you can choose. I don't know which is which.
So here's one, macular degeneration.
That's quite a common one. That's yeah. When you're getting older.
And this is blurring central vision, which is used for detailed tasks like reading and sewing. So I could take that one.
Yeah.
And in fact, I think macular degeneration is one of the symptoms of diabetes, at least it can be.
Possibly, because it's as you're getting older as well.
Yeah. Glaucoma can cause tunnel vision, reduced night vision, and loss of vision in advanced cases.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So these are the three masks I'm choosing from, my third and final.
And this is my condition.
Oh, well, you better tell us what that is then.
Retinitis pigmentosa.
May cause tunnel vision and night blindness. Peripheral side vision is often lost. And you started having this when you were a teenager.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
How did you know what it was when it was?
Took 2 years. Doctors had no idea. So I was in hospital. I think you've read my book where they just had to do lots of tests. And I just thought I was short-sighted. And it just happened that they found out it was this particular eye condition. It hasn't come from anywhere in my family. So it was quite a shock.
Just out of the blue?
Out of the blue.
Just one of those moments of nature?
Out of the blue with puberty. The onset of puberty actually activated my condition.
When, in fact, how you look and how you feel about how you look is really peaking at that time.
Exactly,
And so you were losing vision at the very time you wanted to see what your appearance was.
Well, also, I wanted to be normal. And I was very shy, so I didn't want to stand out from my peers as needing glasses, as needing any special attention or care. So all I wanted to be was normal. And luckily, my friends and family did treat me like that, but a lot of my options for careers basically went out the window back then.
So, Maribel, I'm now going to do something that you write about in your book called Blindness for Beginners.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to simulate what it's like to be losing my vision.
Mm-hmm.
I choose the glaucoma glasses from Vision Australia, which immediately inhibit my side or peripheral vision. Glaucoma is often a painless eye disease, but early detection is vital to prevent full loss of sight. Anyway, here goes.
This towel
is,
I always want to get to my bin quickly, and there are two cupboards here very close together.
Right.
This towel just shows me that's where the bin is.
Okay.
So the tea towel, it's like a beacon, navigates me to my bin.
So can you describe to me what you can see as I speak to you?
Nothing at all, except I have a spotlight over here, but I can't see your face. I have one blind eye, and I'm just going on where your voice is coming for me to try and give you some eye contact.
So you have one blind eye, and the other eye has some degree of light and shade.
Yeah, light and shade.
Right, so that eye is operating with the spotlight over the bench.
Operating with the spotlight. So in my book I talk about if you've got some low vision, you might want to bring in spotlights. And as you can see, I've got one here near the stove and one here where I would be chopping. So that's what I bring in to try and just give me that extra lighting.
Gotcha.
Yeah. But otherwise, no, I can't see you.
And of course, this is what faces vision impaired people every day if they love their food and they want to keep cooking.
Yeah. And one of the things I really want to emphasize is that you don't have to give up cooking if you can't see. You just develop a different way of managing.
Well, let's do this together,
shall
we?
Let's do it.
So what's our dish?
We're doing spaghetti bolognese.
Okay.
And I'm going to take you over here to my computer.
Where you've got the recipe.
Well, where I've just got the ingredients, so you might want to get a bit, little closer.
Because if you're prepared, and that's what Blindness for Beginners as a book is all about, if you're prepared for what's coming, it won't be the kind of shock you had as a teenager.
Exactly. It's like, it's going to be a shock anyway, and there is an adjustment period. Like, you are going to feel upset. It's not a great diagnosis, but I do like to tell people it's not the end of the world. So it's like taking a detour. You're just going to have to find other ways around the situation and get to where you want to go. So initially, yes, you'll feel upset, but there is so much out there that can help us.
Okay.
So let's listen to Jaws, my computer, who's going to tell us the ingredients today. Are we ready?
Let's go.
500 grams minced beef, 1 large onion, 3 cloves garlic, 1 green capsicum, 1 zucchini, 1 tin crushed tomatoes, 1 jar pasta sauce, fresh bunch of parsley, fresh basil leaves, pasta noodles, block of parmesan cheese. That's it, Michael. Let's try not to burn our fingers, okay?
It's like it knows me. That's so brilliant.
Right. It's actually called a screen reader. Yep. So as I type, it's talking to me the whole time. So I've just prepared that ahead of time, but I actually have to be able to touch type to use it.
Right. And as an author and a writer and a speaker, that would be absolutely essential.
Absolutely. And that's how I do all my writing, all my blogs, all my editing, everything with Jaws.
So I like the, is it actually called Jaws? Is that
it's
your
name? It's called Jaws.
I love
but
it.
But it means job access with speech.
So yes. Jaws has kindly provided us with a list of ingredients for spaghetti bolognese, which means one of the scariest moments in anyone who's losing their vision, and I've just done so, is the idea of chopping onions.
Fine. So you've got your board here.
Oh, okay. Let's I'm over here on the left.
Now let's move these glasses so you don't chop them up into the dish.
How did you know they were there if you can't see them?
Oh, I felt them.
Of course you did.
Okay, so come over here.
Yeah.
Now we're going to choose a knife, Michael.
I can't see what knife I need.
Well, have a feel in the drawer and see what you think.
On the right-hand side?
Yes, right-hand side.
Okay. So there's a couple of knives there. I'll take one up. And it's a pink knife. Oh, that's not bad. I like pink.
Yeah, well, you could use that one. Harry uses that one.
That's very sharp.
So you have that one, and I'll show you.
Well, I want it to be sharp. Don't I want a knife to be sharp when I've got low vision?
And I'll show you mine, shall I?
Okay, show me yours.
Now, that's a knife. Okay, it's about a foot long.
Why does having a longer, bigger knife give you the control and precision and safety that you need?
I don't know. I just like this knife.
Oh, okay. I'm so nothing to do with that.
No, I just like this knife. So you've now got your one. I've got
my
mine.
Pink one. Okay.
You've got your board.
And people can't see, of course, what I'm doing because I can't see what I'm doing either.
Now, by the way, sorry.
What else?
You know what comes with your knife?
What?
This.
Band-aids.
Yes.
That's a real leap of faith there.
The show must go on, no matter what, Michael.
So I'm already destined to be a bleeder. Is that what you're saying?
No, I just don't want any accidents, okay? So
this won't stop accidents. It just patches me up afterwards.
Because we've got to keep going.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. So if you see tomato sauce in this bolognese, you know whose it is.
And I can always dial 000.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. So while we're joking around here, I mean, I'm already feeling slightly stressed.
Yes.
I'm gazing intently to look at the knife. I've got it in my hand. I feel secure that it's in my right hand.
So you saw it was pink. So that's interesting. So you still had enough vision to see it was pink.
Yeah, I have that.
Okay. I've got some onions and garlic and a capsicum here. Or maybe I should have let you feel.
I can see them.
Now, because recipe has one onion, but these are quite small.
Yeah.
So you might want to select 3 onions. And I want you to have a feel of the garlic and see if you see anything different about it. From its texture.
Okay, I'm just reaching out with my right hand now to feel the garlic. If you just join me, I have glasses on, which are glaucoma glasses, which stop me from seeing things right in front of me. Where's my knife?
Here.
I love it. Impatience for beginners.
Yes, that's right, exactly.
It's here, you idiot.
You're going to select 3 onions.
Yes.
Because they're small. Now, be very careful. You're going to peel them with your knife.
Yes.
There's a bowl here. Can you feel that? This bowl here is for...
To my right.
That one there.
Yeah.
That deep bowl is to discard.
Well, I was reading in your chapter that you go, in terms of preparing food, you go from left to right across the kitchen, right?
So if you want to put that to your left,
uh-huh.
Your onion is in the middle, and here is the bowl for your When you chop it up, you're going to put it in this bowl to your right.
All right. Got that? I got it, I think.
While you do that, I'm going to start just heating up the oil and cooking the meat.
I take it. It would actually be easier without me being here.
Yes.
When you have social occasions and people come round for dinner parties or gatherings, do you prefer if they don't help?
Yes. There are jobs that they can do, but they will hover. Sighted people will hover and actually watch you cutting because they're like, oh, I don't want anything to go wrong.
Because it's the first time for them.
But it actually makes it worse for me.
Yeah.
And then they stand in the way and I'm trying to get to the oven and they're blocking my way. Or they put a plate closer to me just at the moment where I'm plonking something on it and it goes on the bench.
You told me about the mashed potato in the book.
That's right.
Yeah, you actually plonked mashed potato onto the bench.
Because someone had moved the plate. So it's actually nicer and better for me if people just do other things. They can serve the other guests. They can chat to people, you know, bring things out of the oven. But if I'm needing to run backwards and forwards from my bench to my oven, I sort of need people out the way.
Yes.
So if I'm making a cup of tea for someone and I'm pouring the liquid into the cup, they are staring at me going, would you like me to do that?
So there's tense silences around everything you do.
There's tension.
Yeah. I need to draw attention to something.
That's Harry, Maribel's partner. You've already heard him laughing at my discomfort. At the moment, Harry and Maribel's guide dog, Dindy, are the only fully sighted animals in the room.
The knife has got a safety.
Harry points out, I've been trying to chop my first onion with a knife that has a plastic guard over the blade.
Oh, yes, you might want to take that off.
It's a Japanese knife and it is very sharp. So.
Oh, there it is.
Now it's loaded.
No wonder I was finding it hard to make that first incision. My peripheral vision is very filtered. I can hardly see. And I'm doing all this by feel. So I've got my first onion on the side and I'm doing what I would do in a sighted kitchen. And I'm moving the onion around to the other side and feeling for the end of the stalk because I'm cutting that off as well.
Oh, now I'm nervous.
Don't. It's cool. It's cool.
And now I know how you guys feel.
Now you feel like the sighted person in the kitchen.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, here's a little tip.
Yeah.
How does a blind person buy meat in a supermarket when it's all undercover?
Oh, that's a really good question. How would you do that? Ask the people behind the counter.
Basically, you have to ask or you need to get someone to come with you.
Yeah.
How I do it, feel this.
I'm putting my hand now.
I go to the butchers. So I can
ask. So you're supporting a local person anyway.
Yeah. I get the butcher to give me the exact amount I want. I know what it is. Plus, I can also ask him what else has he got under the counter.
The extraordinary Maribel Steele, who has been almost totally blind since she was a teenager. Maribel's latest book is Blindness for Beginners, and she and I are exploring the tactile kitchen from her point of view. Next time, the dangers of frying without burning, boiling without spillage, and choosing the right herbs and spices to add to the right dish, and why it's important to keep tinned tomatoes and tinned dog food in separate parts of the pantry. Now, moving into aged care, it can feel like a revolution in your life, and not always for the right reasons. But for some, it can open up possibilities. Others, it can feel like, well, those options are being closed down. When Lynette Bruce went into aged care, her lifelong love of painting became a casualty. But then a visit to her facility by local mural artist Jimmy Buscombe just changed all that. Lynette's granddaughter Rosanna has inherited her grandmother's love of painting and now makes a living from her own creative talent thanks to what Lynette was doing early on as an influencer. We're going to hear from both grandmother and granddaughter in this story, and this comes from features reporter Emily Bisland from ABC Southwest Victoria.
My name is Lynette Bruce and I've lived here for just over 4 years.
Lynette Bruce moved into an aged care residency in Warrnambool quite young. She was worried she wouldn't be able to look after herself due to a medical condition. But being so young and still quite sprightly, she found the transition particularly hard.
Once you come into aged care, sometimes it feels like the door is closed and the gate's almost locked because there is an ignorance about people living in aged care. Your friends sometimes don't want to visit, or they visit in the beginning and then those visits become further apart and further apart. And that's a bit sad, really.
My earliest memories of Nana is she's always been crafty and into art. When we were younger, Mum would drop myself and my brother off at her house and we'd have craft days, so she'd have all the paints out ready for us. Yeah, I remember having days with her where we just paint and create things all day. Growing up with her has always been about art and craft.
Rosanna Haywood is Lynette's granddaughter and she's an artist too now. She makes a living from selling her paintings online.
I've moved from portraits and doing realism to abstracts, big colourful, big messy, you know, huge paintbrushes and mess everywhere. That was something that I hadn't done before, but I have memories of Nana liking that. And I remember one thing that she always told me. She said, there's no such thing as a mistake in art, it's just a happy accident. And so I always remember that when I'm doing something and I think, oh no, that doesn't look good.
Before my husband passed away, he said, will you promise not to give your painting away?
Before she moved into Lindock, she had her own little house and she had a studio that she had built onto the house. And whenever we went to visit her, she would always show me things that she'd been working on, her latest paintings, and be really proud of everything that she was making. And every time I saw it, it was always about art and making art. And then when she moved in here, obviously had less space, all her stuff was packed up, and I think she went through a bit of a rough time.
My artwork was always in my mind, really, but I wasn't keen enough to start.
She loves drawing and painting. That's just a thing that she loves. And she always said that was gone, that part of her life's gone, and she's not going to do that again. And
I stopped doing artwork because I came to Lindock, although I did bring one journal. I bought some pencils and some pens, and that journal sat in the bottom of that drawer until Jimmy came.
Jimmy Buscombe is an artist in Warrnambool who's become well known for his mural paintings. He has been an artist in residence at Lindock for 6 months now.
Yeah, I'm going to try this. I don't think this is the right brush, but this is my first flower.
I'm here 12 hours a week over 2 days.
Just don't make them look better than mine, Lynn, and we'll be right.
No. I haven't done flowers. I haven't painted for a long time.
So for the past 7 months, I've been working at Lindock Aged Care Facility in Warrnambool, Lindock Living, painting murals of wildlife. The idea being that I paint beautiful pictures of nature and trees and birds and those sorts of things, and the residents come down and sit with me and chat and watch me paint. And
Jimmy's paintings now line the corridors of Lindock Living. In the dementia ward, you'll find two dancing brolgas. Near the kitchen, there's a washing line where four splendid blue wrens sit on the line next to a big pair of pegged knickers. There are sunflowers and even a finch who's made a little bit of a mess on a light switch.
I remember the first painting I did was of a silver princess gum that I painted with closed flower buds. And then I came back after 2 weeks and I opened up the flower buds so that spring had arrived.
Over the 6 months of Jimmy's artist residency, Lynn has become one of his most devoted observers as he paints live on the walls.
I've enjoyed all of them, but the one that intrigues me the most is the one of the native companions. He had the nest with the eggs in it, and he checked to see how long it took for these new chicks to come alive or out to see us. And he left those eggs on the wall until it was time for them to hatch, and then he hatched out the new native companions.
That's gorgeous.
Yeah, but I like that one because of the colours in the wings and the way the feathers are.
A lot of the same residents come and visit. Lynn's one of them who came from day one and really interacted. She comes down with a lot of the other residents who maybe couldn't come down on their own, so she'll speak to one of the nurses and they'll bring down another resident with her and they'll sit and chat. So it's really inspiring for me to be in this sort of environment. It's like an immediate audience for what I'm doing.
Jimmy's artworks are colourful, wild, cheerful, as is his personality. And while he's been there, Lindock has become more vibrant, more joyous. After a few months, Lynn's family began to notice a change.
I remember I visited Nana not long after he started painting the murals in here. And I could tell a big difference already, because that's when I noticed she started to get her sketchbooks out again and she started to do some drawing and some painting and show me her work. And it wasn't until Jimmy came in and kind of got her inspiration back and her confidence. And I think because she'd love to come and sit and watch him and give him a bit of feedback and let him know, you know, I could look a little bit better. And then he asked to see her sketchbooks one day.
And I was instantly gobsmacked by the quality of her work. And it was right back then that I had the concept of perhaps one day doing a mural with her.
Oh, wow, stand back and look at all the silver, Lynn.
Okay.
It really makes it...
Is that one?
That word again.
Makes pop. It pop. That was, I was trying to find the word. Doesn't it?
Yeah.
It really...
Yeah. I just could not believe that I would be painting again. I couldn't believe it, but I've loved it. But the overwhelming thing is that it was my drawing. And the other joy to me is having Rosanna here, because I don't see her very often because she's a busy mum with her children, and I'd never dreamt that we would be doing something together.
When Jimmy discovered that Lynn's granddaughter was also an artist, he invited her to collaborate on the mural, so the three artists began to paint together.
She reminded me today, oh, Nana, it was so many years ago you were teaching me how to use a stick and gold paint. And so that's so happy. Money couldn't buy it.
The result is a large wall covered in Lynn's butterflies and flowers in gold and silver paint.
The one really important thing was keeping it true to her art and true to her style. And when I see that, I just see that's Nana's. That's Nana's yes. work.
Back to work, girls. And boys.
Put on your pack.
I'll be sorry when this is when you finished here.
Yeah.
Well, it's a treat to see people doing what you're doing and doing it for us.
For me personally, it's been inspiring to come into a place like Lindock Living and see how happy the residents are and how connected they are to what I'm doing. At times there's up to sort of 15, 20 people sitting around watching me paint. It was a hard thing to get used to, but it's a really beautiful part of it for me.
Warrnambool artist Jimmy Buscombe ending that lovely story about Lynette Bruce, aged care resident and passionate painter. You also heard from Lynn's granddaughter, artist Rosanna Haywood, who was influenced by what Lynette was up to. This story was produced by Emily Bislin from ABC Southwest Victoria for Life Matters. I'm Michael McKenzie. Is there a particular tree that you remember from your childhood, or perhaps one you walk past every day? What kind of connection do you have to that tree? What's it bring to your life? For author Sophie Cunningham, trees have been a source of inspiration and also places of contemplation, to pause and reflect on her place in the landscape and the changes that she and the tree have seen in their respective lifetimes. Sophie's new book is called City of Trees, Essays on Life, Death and the Need for a Forest. She's with me now. Hi, Sophie.
Hi.
Tell me how this all began, because you have a following on social media, and I think it started on Instagram. What did you do?
Well, I was taking lots of photos of trees. I was living overseas, so I was sort of not in my own space, and people started getting very enthusiastic about my tree photos, and then someone said, you need an Instagram feed, which is just your trees. They could have been telling me they were a bit bored of having to look at my trees. Anyway, so I siloed the tree posts at Soph Tree of Day, and I've been doing it every day for more than 3 years now.
And what kind of response do you get?
Well, one of the things, the reason why I love it so much is that people send me photos of themselves hugging trees, of their favourite trees. They go to Madagascar and take like amazing photos of those amazing bulb trees.
Yes.
So I do get some wonderful trees through the feed, and trees that I've never even seen. So people, it sort of becomes a way of talking to people, and that was actually what got me deeper into the whole idea of writing a book, was just that realisation that people love trees.
They do.
And that I love trees. And it was when, there's so much kind of noise at the moment, political and, you know, midlife noise, all the things that happen to people. It was just really nice to have something to talk about that brings everyone joy.
And you can say talk to as well, because I suspect you have had a conversation with a tree.
I sort of cuddle them, you know, sort of. But I don't know if I actually say words out loud.
Well, you actually make the point in the book that there's actually quite a few similarities between human beings and trees and the way they can communicate with each other.
They can. Yeah, they have fungal filaments that come up from their roots. They can, different species have different ways of interacting, but they can feed each other sugars. They can warn each other. Particular trees can warn each other when they're in danger from giraffes. Not all trees are in danger from giraffes.
No.
But, they do, and they can keep each other going. There's a tree, an old cork tree at the Abbotswood Convent where I have an office.
This is in Melbourne.
In Melbourne, that fell over but kept being fed by the other cork in the area and sort of just kept going. So it fell over in 1930 in a flood.
Really? And so it's formed a cork support network.
It's sort of like lying on the ground, and then it just started to come back up again. And it looked like it had no roots left in the ground, but it's sort of they do manage to keep themselves going. I mean, keep each other going.
Well, you've lived in other countries. You've travelled around the world. You've witnessed trees in many different settings, and you write about that in the book.
Yeah.
Is there any particular, and I know this must be difficult, but is there any particular one tree that you really felt a very deep connection with?
I think that the River Red Gum, the Australian River Red Gum, and I went up to Barmah Forest National Park now, it was a state park, and spent times among the really old River Red Gum up there. And the giant sequoia in America and in California.
In the Sierra Nevada, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Between Los Angeles and San Francisco. I actually put off going to see them because I thought they can't be as good as everyone goes on about, and it all felt very touristy. And I went to see them only a year ago, and they just, you know, they're amazing. You do feel as if you're standing in one of those amazing old French cathedrals from the, you know, 12th century or something. They soar. I mean, they're...
Well, they may not be the tallest tree. I think the redwood is that. But in terms of sheer bulk on the landscape...
Well, they are the redwood.
Oh, they are the redwood.
Yes,
there's
coastal redwood, and so they are bigger than the coastal ones, which are the ones that are close to California,
right,
where you know, Planet of the Apes was filmed in these among the lesser or the shorter redwoods. But the giant sequoias are they're the among the biggest trees in the world. I think some mountain ash might be taller. I'm not sure.
Just give us a sense of the scale and the power of being amongst those trunks.
Well, the sort of panels, the bark is really fibrous and quite soft, so you can sort of lean into it. It's it's about, I don't know, almost a metre thick. And more, you know, you can, like a hand span, there's these huge panels of kind of soft fibrous stuff. So they're not hard, which is kind of a shock when you realise.
Yes, you'd think they'd have to be really rigid to hold themselves up that high.
Well, and I assume that the middle bit is very rigid, but and it's almost very hard to see the top of them because the crowns can be so high. You have to sort of really crane up. And sometimes you see they get their crowns knocked off in big storms. And so there are quite a few that are very big but then slightly shorter, and that's because they quite often will lose some of their top sections.
Well, if you go online, I went online last night to look at what the scale is, and there were people standing up against some of the trunks of these giant sequoias, and it was like they were standing in front of a house.
Yes. It's like standing in front of a, I don't know, I think I say in the book, I should have checked, 30-story building? Anyway, yeah. It's right. Big.
And you talk about the difficulty of trying to illustrate them somewhere on paper because you kept changing paper size and it never quite worked.
Yes, so I ended up using a picture of a marmot to illustrate because I sort of gave up to, trying to be able to convey. And photographing them is also very hard because you can't really capture how amazing they are. People tell me, I haven't done a lot of whale watching, but there's a similar sense of awe at being in with something, a creature that's so large.
That immensity.
Yeah.
That is natural and living.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. If you just joined us, my guest is author Sophie Cunningham. She's the author of City of Trees, Essays on Life, Death and the Need for a Forest. And we're also wondering what particular tree has played a big role in your memory, your sense of connection to a place in your life. You can leave a comment on Facebook at RN Life Matters and like us while you're there. Sophie, while we put this up on Facebook last night expecting a couple of responses, just like you find with your social media account, Facebook went berserk. People yeah. just want to share their memories. Let me just share this one with you if I could. Meg says, every day, trees stir my emotions and memories and stimulate my thoughts. But one from childhood is the beautiful golden ash that grew in our backyard as kids. It was planted when my late brother was 18 months old, some 65 years ago, broken in two and repaired with a piece of rag by my dad. We climbed its branches and played amongst its strong limbs. Our family home is now a daycare centre, and I wonder if the tree again provides a place for young minds and bodies to flourish.
No, they are. They are. I mean, they do support whole ecosystems, and it includes humans. They support insects and possums, all kinds of creatures.
Yes.
And it's one of the reasons, and a lot of birds live in the little holes in them. So they do. They keep a lot of people going, a lot of the world going.
Well, they've actually been present beyond civilization, and this is some of the more ancient trees that are sadly disappearing from the globe have survived, you know, countless generations of human beings until now.
The giant sequoia I talked about, they can live up to 3,000 years. The ones I was looking at were closer to 2,000 years. So certainly, certainly pre white settlement, but that's a kind of almost, you know, that in itself isn't a big deal. I mean, no. They go right back. The River Red Gums are around through Australia, but particularly around Victoria, are 800 years old. That they way outlive. They have seen all the changes that we have wrought, and indeed seen a lot of changes. And, you know, and Indigenous people have been living among them and using them.
Yes.
As directional trees, as birthing trees to make tools with.
Sorry, what's a birthing tree? Do you mean a place of sacred?
It's a tree that, in fact, it's the source of some contention at the moment because there's a planning permit up near the west, near Ararat. That they're trees that have had the centre slightly burnt out when yes. they were young, so they kind of become rooms and they become private spaces in which women's business is carried out.
I've also seen trees in parts of the country which have been hollowed out or been hollowed by natural forces
yes.
where they smoke eels.
Yes, right.
You know.
And sometimes when I was up in Barmah State or Barmah Forest, I wasn't really sure when the tree had been altered or when it was just had naturally had the centre burnt out because they kind of morph a bit, the kind of the altered trees and the trees that have been naturally altered. I mean, that's why I use the word phrase city of trees is because trees are like buildings in a city. Mm. They are infrastructure.
And the spaces yeah. between them also interconnect populations of yes. other ecosystems.
Yeah.
So, look, we've talked about some of the age of trees and a little bit about the cultural and symbolic nature of trees. But when it comes to, say, a more recent tradition of planting colonnades of trees to
yeah.
often remember the fallen in
the
war.
The memorials, yeah.
Yeah. What feelings do they evoke when you walk through those colonnades?
The more established ones, there's one near Bacchus Marsh, which is incredibly evocative. I find them very moving. I find trees a really important way of remembering things. And the Domain in Melbourne has amazing trees to the fallen. It's got one of the lone pines from Gallipoli.
Yes.
A grandchild of one of the lone pines. So, yeah, they carry a lot of history in them and they evoke a lot of memories and history for people. And I think they're a really wonderful way to remember the dead.
Speaking of that, actually, Kerry on Texas says, favourite tree, you ask, Michael? It's easy. There are so many. The massive ginkgo biloba at our magnificent arboretum here in Canberra and Mrs. Turvey's bountiful mulberry tree visited regularly on the way home from primary school. Mrs. Turvey, you now know who was doing that.
Yes.
but, in fact, Kerry mentioned the ginkgo, and I wanted to mention this tree as well because of its significance after Hiroshima.
Well, I got to know the ginkgo because they were street trees in New York and they seemed to do, not exactly thrive, but do okay in the streetscapes there when most trees couldn't cope. And they're very beautiful trees. But then the more I read, the more I understood that they had survived. They're fossil trees, i.e. they are they're trees that have been with us since prehistoric times.
Yes.
And they, several of them survived Hiroshima and they were one of the first things to bud after, or sort of the first flashes of green after the bomb was dropped.
And that colour on that stark landscape must have been totally arresting. And so, well, and
Temples were built around them as a result, so that the trees kind of, so people worked with the trees rather than the other way around, which is something I commend the people of Hiroshima for doing. And so the trees they become symbols of hope as well, not just memorials of grief, but symbols of hope because they are so resilient.
And I love the way they get their revenge, I think, every spring or something when
they really smell, some of them do.
They drop their seeds and they smell like vomit, apparently.
Yes, they
do. And other things.
Yes. Well, I actually assumed that people just vomited in New York a lot until I went online and realised what was going on.
Eucalyptus trees define much of the Australian landscape, except they've also found their way into populations of trees in many other countries, parts of Europe and the US particularly as well. How do you feel about introduced species in a landscape where they may be magnificent but actually not native?
I think it's probably the most complicated question I look at in the book. I think that there is a point to introducing some trees. Well, let me put it this way. Once introduced, I'm not quite sure what the point of removing them, because if they are thriving in that landscape and if they're providing some kind of sustenance. And what they were trying to do in California when I was there was sort of remove them all as a job lot, and there are millions of them, which, given that they'd already lost most of the redwood and the oak trees, it was unclear what they were going to be replaced with. Now, if there had been this amazing sort of program for replanting back to the original landscape, that would have been one thing, but I don't know that there was. Also, with climate change, what is the original landscape? What are you returning the land back to? San Francisco was a whole lot of sand dunes that people, you know, that the eucalypts were partly there to kind of make it less sand duney and kind of hold the land together.
So every species on its merits, do you think?
Well, yes. I'm not a lover of, say, the cane toad. I mean, I can see that introduced species can cause a lot of damage. But I do think there's an obsession with invasive species that isn't always useful. In Florida at the moment, North Florida, some mangroves are being called invasive species because they only used to grow south. But the reason why they're moving north is because of the eroding coastline and the changing climate. So it's not a particularly useful way of seeing the world, which doesn't mean there aren't particular trees that cause problems.
Just quickly, if I may, Sophie, Daniel writes from Tweed Heads on text, "The drive from Katherine to Timber Creek is such an amazing experience as you approach the limited zone where boabs grow.
Yeah.
They are the wise old mothers that have been part of the landscape for hundreds of years. Such a spiritual experience to be amongst those icons of the Kimberley." And, of course, in that place, that's the Northern Territory.
So. Yes. No, there are some amazing trees up there.
Sophie, it's a fantastic book because you ruminate about what's disappearing, what needs to be replenished and how much time we don't have to get the job done. But also there is a great connection and love, clearly, between you and most of the trees that stand tall that still exist in our various towns, parks, cities and bush. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Sophie Cunningham, author of City of Trees, Essays on Life, Death and the Need for a Forest. Are there particular trees that resonate with you that you couldn't imagine life without? Well, in fact, you said yes resoundingly. We had enormous responses on Facebook and text. People were sending us photographs of the favourite trees they've had in their life, dating back to childhood. David texted to say, "Hi, Michael, just to clarify, coastal redwoods are the tallest tree in the world. Giant sequoias are the largest trees by volume in the world." What he means by that is they're just bigger in terms of bulk. And he also says mountain ash are the tallest flowering plants on the planet. Kim writes on Facebook about the trees in her life and says, well, there was the pepper tree in our backyard that had a special branch that made the whole thing into a house, and it used to leave my hands sticky and a bit smelly with sap. Beside that was the jacaranda tree that never really took off size-wise, but my horse would scrape my smug brothers off her with it. You can read more of these beautiful tree stories at the RN Life Matters Facebook pages. Don't forget to like us while you're there. I'm Michael McKenzie, and Hilary Harper and I will be back next week. In the meantime, you can find all our stories on the ABC Listen app. Talk soon.